Might be your pinch yourself moments. We've been talking about reunions because of my reunion on air with a neighbour that I hadn't seen for 23 years. Absolutely amazing. Got another hour of the programme to go. Don't get me wrong, this ain't the end of it. We'll have newscasts for you in a moment or two, and that'll be fascinating, no doubt.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. Figures obtained by BBC News show the number of times machetes, swords and so-called zombie knives have been logged by police has almost doubled in the last 5 years. From tomorrow, it'll be illegal to possess zombie-style knives and machetes in England and Wales, as a knife amnesty in place for people to surrender the weapons without prosecution comes to an end. Pooja Kanda's son, Ronan, was murdered in a case of mistaken identity in June 2022. She wants the online sale of all big knives to be banned.
I'm shocked they were available when this happened to my child. And I am more shocked that they are still continuing to be available after what happened to Ronan. And I can't have that happen to another child. I just can't.
Rachel Reeves will use her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to try to persuade her critics that there won't be a return to austerity. She will promise an October budget of real ambition and say her optimism for Britain is as strong as ever. But her key message is risks being overshadowed by questions about party donations and criticism over the decision to means test winter fuel payments. The business secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, has insisted Labour wants to bring back hope to Britain.
What the Chancellor will want to be getting across is the good times that we want to bring, the hope for the future. Look, sometimes you've got to make difficult decisions early on to give the stability. You don't want to repeat the disaster of Liz Truss, for instance. Where there's got to be a tough decision, it's for a purpose, and it is that better future. But yes, we want people to be better off, we want hope to return to Britain, and that's message of change beginning, but that is why we've had to make those difficult decisions.
The UN has warned that the Middle East is on the brink of imminent catastrophe amid fears of an all-out war. Fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed group Hezbollah in Lebanon intensified over the weekend, with both sides carrying out large cross-border strikes. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has promised further action unless Hezbollah backs down. New analysis of government data suggests on average more than 50 pubs a month have closed in England and Wales during the first half of this year. In comparison, a total of 472 pubs called their last orders during the last full financial year. The pandemic, the impact of inflation and cost of living pressures are being blamed for the closures. And celebrations have been held to mark the 50th anniversary of the launch of CFAX. Considered technologically groundbreaking at the time, the service used colourful text and chunky graphics to provide news, weather and sports reports to those with enabled television. It was discontinued by the BBC in 2012. Ian Morton-Smith was part of the original launch team.
I think there were four sets when CFAX first started that were equipped to receive the signal. And by the time I left, there were 22 million viewers. You controlled access to the information. That's what makes CFAX special. And then, of course, along came the internet and killed it stone dead.
BBC News, it's 3 minutes past four.
This week on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tomorrow at 7.45, Newcastle United travel to AFC Wimbledon in the EFL Cup. And 5 Sports Extra has ball-by-ball coverage of England versus Australia in the third ODI. And tonight from 7, join Mark Chapman for the Monday Night Club.
Evening, welcome along to 5 Live Sports.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Jotun Adebayo. BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yeah, this is the nightclub on BBC Radio 5 Live. I'm your night watchman. There are just 43 days until the US election. And this time last week, we were bringing you the news of a second assassination attempt on Republican candidate Donald Trump. Well, let's bring you the latest on the presidential race and how those attempts on Mr. Trump's life have changed things with Justin and the rest of the team with AmeriCast from BBC Sounds.
Two big problems when presidents and people running for the presidency are shot at and otherwise harassed and attacked. Number one is a practical one. What do? They can't go out and be with the people, and that affects a campaign. Number two is a bigger one. It affects America, doesn't it? Because if you can't have proper campaigns and you can't trust people in most circumstances to be peaceful, then that plainly undermines democracy. Donald Trump talking about the second attempt on his life and, as you might expect, using it for the best political gain he could get out of it.
And God has now spared my life. It must have been God. Thank you. Not once, but twice. And there are those that say he did it because Trump is going to turn this state around. He's going to turn this country around. He's going to make America great again. And maybe.
Well, all right. But a more prosaic question. How does the Secret Service, how does America protect the people at the top of its politics? Welcome to Americast.
Americast.
Americast from BBC News.
There was blood pouring everywhere, and yet I had God on my side.
So I decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
We're effectively run in this country by a bunch of childless cat ladies.
You know it, you feel it. These guys are creepy, and yes, just weird as hell.
Let Trumpomania run wild, brother.
Let us choose joy.
Hello, it's Justin in the worldwide headquarters of Americast in London, England.
I thought we decided that wasn't funny anymore. It's Sarah here, and I'm in Springfield, Ohio.
And it's Mariana, a.k.a. Misinformation, also in London, also in what we are still very boringly calling the worldwide headquarters of Americast.
OK, it's not funny, but we're doing it all the same, and there's quite a lot that falls into that category. Anyway, Sarah, you're in an interesting place. Why?
Well, everyone will remember that Springfield, Ohio, is where Donald Trump said that Haitian migrants were taking people's pet cats and dogs and using them for food. Completely untrue, totally baseless rumour, of which there'd been a little bit online, but that he used during the presidential debate to try and highlight immigration. And so I've come here to see what the effects of the consequences have been. And it's beginning to dawn on me, maybe I should have realised in this in the beginning, Justin, maybe you did, this wasn't a mistake. No matter how much it's been mocked by Democrats and liberals for repeating these ridiculous lies about people's pets being stolen, actually, it's, you know, it's part of his brain's focus on the issues as he's tried to talk more about migrants in cities and less about them coming across the southern border. I'm here, everybody here is talking about it, and you know, I think actually this is exactly what Donald Trump wanted.
Yeah, and we're having a whole episode about safety and the safety of the main protagonists, but obviously there is a safety issue, isn't there, for the people of Springfield, Ohio, particularly Haitian immigrants, most of whom, it should be said, are there legally.
Yes, most of them have got temporary protected status now here completely legally and are working. But the security threats are very real. There have been over 30 bomb threats dialed into local schools. They've had to close. Parents were called up one day and said, come and get your kids as quickly as you can. And we've been told there's a bomb in the school. Absolutely terrifying for everybody. Some Haitian kids in that school, but most of them were not. The hospitals have had a couple of bomb threats as well. And I've been speaking to Haitian migrants as well that I've met who say they've had really hateful comments in the street. They feel intimidated. Some of them say they don't want to leave their homes anymore. But it's not just them. I mean, this is really impacting everybody in Springfield simply because Donald Trump made these comments about something that's not even true.
And that then brings us to the presidential stuff. And of course, it has been one of the things the Trump campaign have been saying is that the rhetoric about Trump being a threat is one of the things that have led to people trying to kill him. We're going to be talking in a second to a former Secret Service agent. But first, let's focus on the Secret Service itself and whether it's failing. Because there is, Sarah, a real debate now, isn't there, about not just about the Secret Service, but about the way it's funded, about the way it's set up, and about who actually is able to get its services.
Yeah, because I don't think you have to be politically minded to see something is going wrong here. That, you know, Trump was nearly shot 2 months ago and somebody was able to get an armed rifle so close to him. Nobody can pretend that this is okay. And of course, powers, no matter what side of the political divide you're on, is deeply, deeply worrying. So, yeah, people are starting to talk about the fact that there clearly are not enough resources with the Secret Service. Now, Trump's team cast aspersions that he has been deliberately denied extra security. From the White House, Joe Biden says, well, it's time for Congress to send more money to the Secret Service so that they can do more, because actually they're under huge strain because they're giving full presidential protection to the president, Biden, obviously, and just about as much to both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. That's very unusual. And then there's some other figures like Hillary Clinton who get more than normal amounts of protection. So, yeah, so they're hugely under strain. And there's an economic debate to be had about who should pay for that, which ultimately goes down to Congress. But, of course, you know, we're 6 weeks away from an election. This is obviously going to get very political as well.
And it's interesting, isn't it, this business of who gets what level of protection and whether someone who is running for president gets a certain level and someone else doesn't. And it's crucial in the Trump case, we should listen to a clip about this. What if you're a former president and you know that there are a lot of threats against you and then you're running for president?
Well, you got to understand the golf course is surrounded by shrubbery. So when somebody gets into the shrubbery, they're pretty much out of sight. All right. And at this level that he is at right now, he's not the sitting president. If he was, we would have had this entire golf course around it. But because he's not, the security is limited to the areas that the Secret Service deems possible.
So that was Rick Bradshaw, who's the Palm Beach County Sheriff. He's talking about, of course, the golf course where the second attempt on Trump's life seemed to be about to happen. There was certainly a man in the bushes with a gun. And Sarah, that led then, didn't it, to a whole set of other questions about, well, hang on a second, why are you making these kind of grades of coverage when there is an obvious threat to this guy?
Yeah, and I think this is the first time, actually, people have ever talked about giving full presidential levels of security to somebody who's a candidate or a former president. But you've got to look at the threat. You'll remember just Barack Obama got Secret Service protection much, much earlier than a presidential candidate would normally, because there were more threats made against him because he was the first black man who looked like he had a chance of becoming president. Donald Trump, for other reasons, you know, has a serious security threat against him. So, yeah, people are starting to ask questions about whether he deserves the full Monty, so to speak. But I was in West Palm Beach just before I came to Springfield. I went down there as soon as we got the news of what had happened on Donald Trump's golf course. And I have to say, even when they'd closed off one bit of the public road where the gunman had been able to get near the golf course, there was traffic chaos. If they closed off all of the roads around that golf course every time he went to play, nobody in West Palm Beach would be able to get anywhere. Donald Trump probably wouldn't be very pleased about the fact that he was upsetting all of his voters and constituents like that. But you know, these, I assume, and we'll find out later in the programme, it's got to be some of the things that you have to balance your considerations with.
Yeah, I mean, I remember with the Obama years, I remember being really shocked. I was a bit naive, I suppose. I went into a coffee shop in South Carolina during the primary when Obama was against Hillary Clinton. And I was saying to these sort of black women there, and I was saying, you're going for Obama, you're all supporting him. And they all, to a person, they said no. And they all had kids of that kind of age. They'd voted in a few elections. They'd thought about these things. They were all voters. And they all said, we don't want Obama to win because he's got a lovely family and he'll be killed. They were certain that he'd be shot. And I found it really shocking, actually, that a nation that lectures the rest of the world on functioning democracies, etc., can have that level of, and they weren't making it up, too. There was a real threat, obviously, a set of real threats to Obama. And America has lived with this, of course, for a long time. But occasionally it just comes to the fore. And thankfully, during the Obama era, it didn't. But that threat in the background, Mariana, it's always been there. And now with social media and all the rest of it, it seems to be accentuated.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying that political violence has existed in America for a whole lot longer than social media has. But there's something about the environment that social media appears to create, and particularly the algorithms, the computer systems, the recommendation systems that I talk about a lot, that are effectively designed to prioritize engagement over safety of users. And what that means is that they will push stuff that gets a reaction. And so you get to this place where, as we've chatted about loads, people are kind of hunkered down in their own echo chambers. They're seeing stuff that's more and more extreme on particular topics or ideas. The vast majority of people who might get embroiled in stuff that's not true or into kind of really heated debates online would never do anything. But the noise on social media and the level of hate and what that can feel like and what that can do to the very small minority of people who might act on those things, I think is the point we're getting to here. And I think there's also something that's important to talk about, and perhaps it's also to do with how the Secret Service works, which is to what extent it is effectively monitoring the online world and all of the different spaces. Like, we're not just talking about, you know, the mainstream social media feeds, the stuff that's all publicly available. We're also kind of talking about Telegram channels, different private groups, communications that are happening in a way that's covert, out of sight, all that sorts of stuff. In the same way that people monitor, you know, the organisation of individuals who might commit acts of terror or involved in other extreme groups.
But I tell you, Marietta, what I think is surprising, Justin, I don't know whether you will agree. I mean, it's shocking, obviously, that anybody could get this close to a presidential candidate. I think what's surprising, though, is that it's a right-wing figure like Donald Trump who's being targeted, because exactly that story you were telling about people's fears about President Obama illustrates that often it has been perceived that the threat would come from the right to somebody on the left who was challenging the status quo. And in fact, what we're looking at here is just quite the opposite.
I think that's a really important point, Sarah, and I think that actually tells us something really vital to understand about how this kind of rhetoric on social media and then this kind of behaviour offline is not limited to one particular political group or people of one political side or another. A lot of this is about being driven towards extreme points on either side. And there's a new series I've got coming out next week, Why Do You Hate Me, USA?
Which looks at exactly this. How does she do it?
Yeah, it looks at exactly this. We're obviously talking about presidents and presidential candidates. But actually, exactly like you said, Sarah, about all, you know, the average person, the average school in Springfield, Ohio, I've spent some time hanging out with election workers in Colorado for this new podcast series as well. You know, people who are like an IT manager who is suddenly like, I'm being threatened for doing my job. And I think most people didn't even know what my job was before, but they believe I'm complicit in plots to, you know, steal the election or rig the election process. And that tends to be, from what they've shown me and what I've seen, hate and threats coming from people who support Donald Trump and believe the election was stolen. But then you've now got people who are on the left who believe, for example, Trump staged the assassination.
Oh, yeah. I met one evidence. The other day and she listens to the podcast.
Oh, well, there you go.
I mean, she listens to the podcast, perfectly reasonable woman, very reasonable woman. I better say that, hadn't I? Because she's probably listening to this. But she didn't exactly say the whole thing's made up, but she said she had questions about it. And that goes to Sarah's point, doesn't it? That actually there's this, you know, how could it possibly be us? How could it be us? Why? I think they're quite surprised, actually, at the whole thing. The idea that Trump is being targeted is actually rather annoying for them, because he's not your obvious victim.
Yeah, but there's also this huge gap, I guess, between people actually believing this stuff and then acting on it. And the reason this is all relevant to the Secret Service and protection and everything else is because it's about people getting sucked into this who might not have before, and what that means for the people who are getting sucked really deep into it and then might behave in a way that's more extreme or be emboldened to behave in a way that they might have thought about anyway, but it makes them think it's kind of normal and all right.
Sarah, what about this idea that somehow at the back of everyone's minds now is the way these things tend to spiral out of control? You think back to 1968 or to the late 60s, actually, but quite a few assassinations and attempts that year, and then running straight into the 1970s. In other words, you kind of get into a mindset, and America kind of gets into a funk, a violent funk, that it can't find its way out of. And I think there are quite a lot of people, aren't there, who fear that that's happening now.
Absolutely. And I've talked to people, even just coming to a place like Springfield, Ohio, and talking about the atmosphere around the election, and not even specific to the story here. There is a genuine fear among lots of people that someone is going to get killed before Election Day, that there will at least be another attempt, whether against Donald Trump or his opponents, because you have to wonder what these attempts on Donald Trump's life are doing to the very people who probably believe him, that these attempts on his life are being inspired by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. There is an incendiary atmosphere around here that feels really quite dangerous, to be perfectly honest, and the threat of political violence has never felt more real, because you see the divisions getting heightened in small communities as well as this national stage in which we see these attempts at a presidential candidate's life. And it does bring into focus what responsibility senior politicians have for toning down the rhetoric. It's one thing what happens online, as Mariana's describing, but the people with the very largest microphone and the biggest bully pulpit, do they have some responsibility to temper their language? Donald Trump thinks so. He says that it is because Joe Biden, Kamala Harris and other Democrats constantly describe him as a threat to democracy that he's being targeted, that they actually set up the conditions for people to try and take his life because they described him as a threat to the American way of life. That inspired people to try and take him out.
Right, on that rather depressing note, I think you've got to go, haven't you, Mariana?
I do. I've tried really hard, by the way, Americas, not to make this joke because it's not a very funny topic. However, I should just say to you that Justin is dressed like he's a member of the Secret Service for this podcast record, okay, including with our little earpieces in and in his suit. So it feels like me and Sarah didn't quite get the memo.
I'm wearing a suit because I have to go to an undisclosed location to do an undisclosed thing after the podcast. And I've got a very nice silver case to go with it that looks as if it should have the nuclear codes in it, but actually has a toothbrush.
I don't think we'll start dressing thematically for every episode. I'm glad you have today.
Delighted to say we have on the line Bill Gage, who joined the Secret Service quite a long time ago, back in 2002. He's provided a lot of protection to presidents, to vice presidents, to foreign dignitaries as well, because, of course, it's a wider job than just the president or people vying to be president. He was on the counter-assault team as well, protection for George W. Bush after the Iraq War, when there were a lot of terror threats, of course, against the United States and against, personally, against George W. Bush. But also Barack Obama, also, as we've already been talking about, the potential target of racially motivated attacks. Bill, you are exactly the right person to talk to. What an extraordinary career you've had.
I'm a pretty humble guy. You're embarrassing me there a little bit. But it is what it is. Great experience. The Secret Service is an incredible job. You know, it takes a toll on your personal life. You're gone 150, 200 days a year sometimes. And you live by somebody else's schedule.
Yeah.
And but an amazing experience. I got to see and do things that you either dream about as a kid or you see in movies.
We want to try and get into all of your experience, obviously, and learn what we can about the Secret Service. But just in headline terms to start with, when you heard that somebody had, well, a bullet had grazed former President Trump at a rally, and then this week also heard that somebody else had got close to him with a rifle, what was your first reaction?
Well, you know, if we don't mind, we'll break down both attempts, because the first attempt, it was kind of an off day for me and my family, just kind of hanging out around our house. And a friend texted me to turn the news on, and I turned the news on, and it had just happened within a couple minutes. And I turned to my wife and I said, how could somebody have got a firearm into the event? Because I assumed it was someone in the crowd. And the Secret Service is divided up into two sort of sections, if you will. There's the uniform division and then the special agent side. And the uniform division provides security around the White House, the sort of physical security for the White House. But they also sort of man, or they're responsible for the magnetometers at all of these events that physically screen people before coming into the event. And these are some of the most sensitive magnetometers in the world. These uniform division officers are the most highly trained problem in the world. I mean, can pick up metal shavings in your pocket. They're so sensitive. And so, you know, just knowing what I know, I made some sort of professional guesses there that there was some real miscommunication between the local police officers and the Secret Service advance team about who was covering that specific building. And let me just wrap this up really quickly. It's not what you see on TV, okay? So perfect world, the service would have put 1,000 agents in Butler, Pennsylvania with 100 counter sniper teams, and everybody has a DNA sample on file that the Secret Service has screened. They know everything about everybody in the crowd. You know, agents have these Google glasses, lens glasses, that facial recognition software that's tied into drones with missiles. You know, that's just not the reality of protection. It's not like you see in the movies.
I'm really interested by that, because I want it to be more like in the movies, or maybe I don't because of the freedom aspect of it. But how high tech is it? I mean, is it, you talked about the metal detectors, and obviously there are a lot of very highly armed people around a president or a presidential candidate. But does it go any further than that?
Well, there are a lot of what we would call classified here in the United States. The Secret Service has a lot of classified assets that they do use at these events. But just to circle back and answer your question there, a lot of it is low tech. It's just agents on the ground using their critical judgment and reasoning and their training, putting together these protective models that the Secret Service has used for decades that have been really successful. So it's kind of a combination of tech and just kind of good old fashioned, what we call here in America, gumshoe, you know, just agents walking around doing their job. So it's a combination of both.
But what about online gumshoe, as it were? I mean, are you really aware? Are agents really aware? Is the service really aware of what people are, how they're interacting online and kind of potential threats that, that seem to be obvious from people's social media profiles? Or is it, I mean, is that just a crazy thing to ask because there are so many people spewing such a lot of hate that you wouldn't know where to start?
You guys, I just feel like your law enforcement and intelligence agencies are leaps and bounds ahead technology wise. And I feel like we are. And that's what exactly what I was going to get into there was that, you know, for the most part, America and Britain, not a surveillance state, right? Like China or Russia, both of these most recent potential assassins against President Trump in China or Russia would have been jailed years ago, or at least the most recent assassin for his anti-government feelings. You know, they just would have jailed him and you never hear from him again. So for the most part, we're not a surveillance state here in America. It's a free democracy, just like Britain. And, you know, within reason, you can say or do whatever you want online. It's a crime in America to talk about assassinating the president as a threat. I mean, you and I can talk about it sort of academically, right? But if I go online and say, I hate the president, he should die, someone's going to be looking into that. And these tech companies, you know, they've all of these tech companies have algorithms that are constantly, supercomputers are constantly searching for these words and phrases and combinations of words and phrases. And those kind of things get flagged. And then they get sent to the Secret Service. In addition, the Secret Service has dozens and dozens of agents and intelligence personnel. Their job every day is just to sit there and scrub social media and look for these kind of threats.
Well, this is really fascinating, but it's obvious something has gone wrong in both of these assassination attempts against Donald Trump. How can we tell as lay people looking at this whether the mistake is not enough resources on his team or incompetence?
I think human nature, we want to find out, okay, I want that one thing that went wrong, right? When there's a tragedy or a major incident, we're always looking, I want that one explanation. I think just knowing what I know from outside, being on the inside at one point and now on the outside, but just knowing what I know, it's a combination of things. It's a combination of the Secret Service. Every director since 9/11, not going to Congress and asking for more money and resources over several decades, and which causes kind of a ripple effect, right? Like a compounding issue year after year after year with increasing mission demands. You know, I think it's a combination of factors. And so, you know, was human error involved in Butler, Pennsylvania and in the golf course? Possibly. I think that will come out in some of the reports. But in my opinion, again, formerly being on the inside, I think it's mostly going to be an issue of resources with a little bit of possibly incompetence.
Yeah. Tell us more about the golf side of all of this, because you must have spent a lot of your time on golf courses. It is weird. Is it something about presidents and golf and just the difficulty of looking after them on the course?
Yeah. And the Secret Service uses sort of a protective model they've used here in America. You guys are probably familiar from World War II history, but Dwight D. Eisenhower was sort of the first president that the Secret Service had to protect routinely on a golf course. And that many years ago, the Secret Service kind of came up with this golf course protective model where you have agents, you know, a few holes ahead. You have agents behind, sort of covering the rear guard. And then you're going to have agents directly around the president as they golf. And that protective model is pretty sound. Part of that model is you're going to have agents dressed like golfers that are actually golfing to sort of blend in, playing golf, but actually in the golf bag is going to be some weaponry. So, you know, that model has kind of stuck and been very successful. There's also going to be counter sniper teams and counter assault teams like what I was on the CAT team there as well. And so listen, golf courses are like mini nature preserves, right? I mean, there's wood lines, sand traps, water hazards. Yeah. And, you know, I'm a golfer. I love the game. And what the average hole is, you know, 300 plus yards. You multiply that times 18 holes. And, you know, it's extremely difficult to protect presidents when they're golfing. President Obama would frequently golf at military golf courses. And those were just a little bit easier to protect because here in America, the president's viewed as the commander in chief. And I can remember multiple times where very high ranking military officers would be have a tee time. They would have it reserved weeks in advance and they show up to play and they're turned away, generals and colonels, because they're like, no, the president's on his way to golf here. And they would, you know, high ranking officers be turned away. And so these military courses were much easier to secure in some aspects because we could just shut the whole thing down.
Maybe that's the future of presidential golfing. It goes back to the military president. We've got to let you go in a second. We're just going to ask you this. Were you on the tour? I can't remember. Was it Obama or Bush who went to Slovakia? I remember something really weird happening there. And I sat next to on the plane, on the press plane, a Secret Service guy who told me some absolutely hair-raising stories of things that happened behind the scenes. I just wanted to finish with the kind of weirdest thing that ever happened to you. Because I remember on that trip, for me, it was really peculiar. I got trapped outside the kind of bubble, the presidential bubble. And I was I didn't have my passport because those, of course, were taken by the White House. And I was quite worried, actually, about how I'd get in. And I just caught this guy's eye. And he just went up to this huge line of Slovakian riot police and just said to them, I want that guy inside. And the line parted. It was like, the Red Sea. They just parted because of the extraordinary authority that this guy had. So it's a weird job, isn't it? Because you do sometimes have a lot of ability to do stuff, but at the same time, you've got this kind of stress in your mind that there is a constant threat, not just to the life of the principal, but actually potentially to yours as well.
Yeah. And listen, I have, dozens of stories, and I don't want to hyperbole here or over-exaggerate, but, there were times where there were serious geopolitical consequences for stuff that was happening real time. There was a time in Mumbai, India, where we discovered an Indian police sniper, but we didn't know it at the time. He was covered in a ghillie suit, and we thought it was an actual sniper. It was looking at Obama through his rifle scope. And we had to make a decision, were we going to immediately burst into this speech with President Obama? The decision was made to give it a few seconds, and we sent a multitude of police and Secret Service up there, and it turned out it was just some silly Indian police sniper that didn't get the memo that, you can't do that. So there were times like that, but then there were other times where I went to Afghanistan once with the president, President Obama, and my CAT team had been up for like 36 hours straight. And another team relieved us. And there's always a backup plane, a backup Air Force One that flies everywhere with the president in case there's a problem with the primary plane. And we were lucky enough to fly back on the backup plane. And it was just my CAT team, just like six or seven of us and nobody else on the plane. And we got airborne, and one of the flight attendants came back and said, listen, there was kind of a mess up. We have a bunch of Buffalo hot wings and a bunch of ice cold Yingling beer. And we kind of got to get rid of it before we land in Germany. And so we
managed
we ate all these Buffalo wings, drank Yingling. And a dirty little secret is, on the presidential planes, the president has access to movies that haven't been released yet into Hollywood. So a president gets them like several weeks before they're actually released. So we were able to watch all these movies that hadn't even been released yet. So there were moments like that in the Secret Service that I remember, just kind of these like, wow, this is a really cool job. And, but there were also times, like I said, that there were really geopolitical consequences if you got it wrong.
Bill, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
I'm glad to hear there are some perks among all of the risks that you were taking, Bill.
That's right. Thanks a lot, Bill. Really, really huge pleasure to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. I love the UK. I'm going to go over again and visit someday. So I love you guys and I love the BBC. I listen all the time.
Wonderful.
Thanks for joining us, Bill.
We're honored to have you. Thanks, Bill.
Bye, guys.
That's it. WhatsApp 443301239. 9480, americast@bbc.co.uk. The hashtag's Americast. Discord, the link's in the description. You can hear Americast as a podcast, of course, on BBC Sounds. See you all later.
Americast.
Americast from BBC News.
Thanks for listening to Americast from BBC News. You can subscribe to this podcast on the free BBC Sounds app, which is now available worldwide.
Yeah, I love the BBC. I love the UK. I listen all the time to the BBC when I'm not talking. And there'll be another BBC Sounds podcast about the same time tomorrow morning. The time now, though, is 4:34.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News on 5 Live. The number of times machetes, swords and what's known as zombie knives have been logged by police has almost doubled in the last 5 years. From tomorrow, it'll be illegal to possess zombie-style knives and machetes in England and Wales. Rachel Reeves will use her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to try to persuade her critics that there won't be a return to austerity. She'll promise an October budget of real ambition and say her optimism for Britain is as strong as ever. But her key message risks being overshadowed by questions about party donations and criticism over the decision to means test winter fuel payment. And new analysis of government data suggests on average more than 50 pubs a month have closed in England and Wales during the first half of this year. The pandemic, the impact of inflation and the cost of living pressures are being blamed for the closures. Five Live Sport, here's Andy Barwell.
Manchester City moved back to the top of the Premier League table, but their perfect record isn't intact anymore. It followed a pulsating 2-2 draw with their title rivals Arsenal, who remain unbeaten. After Leandro Trossard's sending off in first half stoppage time, some resolute defending looked like claiming Arsenal the victory at the Etihad Stadium, only for John Stones to get the City equaliser in the 98th minute. Let's hear now from the two bosses in a moment, Mikel Arteta, but first Pep Guardiola.
It's better than defeat. We prefer to win. We start really well. Many things happen in the game. Many things happen in the game, but yeah, we handle it good, and at the end we can rescue a point.
We did a lot of things good, but it's very difficult. It's an accident waiting to happen. You play the best team in the world for 56 minutes with 10 men, which doesn't allow you to put any pressure on the ball, doesn't allow you to get out from your own box, and they don't lose the ball. So they lose it inside the six-yard box, which means that there's no option either to run. So very complicated, but again, for these players to be that humble and that disciplined and show that competitiveness is just incredible.
Brighton drew 2-2 with Nottingham Forest. Both managers there were sent off late on in the game, along with the Forest player Morgan Gibbs-White. After Celtic's 5-2 victory over Falkirk in the Scottish League Cup, the Old Firm have been kept apart in the semi-finals. Celtic will take on Aberdeen. Motherwell will play Rangers. Vivian Miedema scored one goal and made another on her return to the Emirates Stadium. Manchester City drew 2-2 with their former club Arsenal in their Women's Super League opener. And Celtic beat their Ukrainian opponents 1-0 in the first leg of the Women's Champions League qualifier. The return is on Thursday, with the winner going through to the group stages. After the victory for McLaren's Lando Norris in the Singapore Grand Prix, Max Verstappen's lead in the F1 Drivers' Championship is down to 52 points with 6 races to go. The American Billy Horschel claimed the European Tour's PGA Championship title at Wentworth for the second time in 4 years, and they'll try again at Trent Bridge today for cricket's 50-over one-day cup final, with Somerset facing Glamorgan.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Just starting off with the idea that on Sunday we had some really intense downpours. Woburn had 102 millimetres of rain, which was nearly double their September average rainfall, and 59 millimetres of rain, more than a month's worth, fell in just the space of 2 hours. Nearby in Dunstable, well, the high street was underwater with some severe flooding at one stage on Sunday. I'm telling you this because we've got more of the same to come, I'm afraid, for Monday, with a threat of some extreme rainfall building in. Now, the Met Office got an amber weather warning that takes in much of Lincolnshire, Yorkshire, most of the Midlands, That could well be extended through the day to encompass parts of central southern England as well, where the weather looks like it will also be extraordinarily wet. How much rain? Well, we're looking at around 80 to as much as 120 millimetres of rain for some communities within this area. So we're talking basically about 2 months' worth of rainfall in the space of a day. And, like Dunstable yesterday, I think that is likely lead to some severe flooding in one or two communities later on today. Flash flooding and maybe some river flooding as well. So there are the areas most at concern, but the thunderstorm's going to be pretty widespread across England and Wales through the day. Northern Ireland, Western Scotland having broken cloud and sunny spells. Eastern Scotland staying rather cloudy with mist patches. And Northern Scotland, a change in the weather picture here as a cold front moves in, bringing a spell of rain and cooler weather conditions. Indeed, temperatures will be around 13 degrees. For the rest of the UK, temperatures are about 16 to 20, but we're majoring on the risk of flash flooding from some of those extreme downpours that we'll have across parts of England, maybe sneaking into parts of East Wales as well. Now, beyond that, the rain will tend to become lighter and patchier across England on Tuesday before clearing out of the way. Sunny spells follow Northern Ireland, England and Wales, but in Scotland, more extensive rain for Tuesday as a cold front moves in, and that will be bringing chillier weather to Scotland on Tuesday and to all of the UK as we go through the week ahead. Chris Fawkes, 5 Live Weather.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Dr. Adebayo. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, you might remember that last week I was telling you about my wife's godson. He was about to have a kidney transplant, and I wanted to know what help I could offer him. I wanted you to share your experiences of it. And you shared some incredible stories with me of your own experiences of receiving organ donations or donating the organs of loved ones to save others. Well, this week is Organ Donation Week, coincidentally. So let's go back to the subject of the importance of organ transplant and find out some more. Anthony Clarkson is the Director of Organ and Tissue Donation and Transplantation at NHS Blood and Transplant. And Natalie Kerr is an organ recipient. I chatted to them earlier. And first, Natalie shared her story.
Was diagnosed with a rare lung disease when I was in labour with my daughter, which was 16 years ago now. And I was diagnosed with a lung disease called pulmonary hypertension, which is where the blood vessels in the lungs get progressively narrow. And that obviously puts a strain on your heart and you can't get your breath. And that's a very progressive illness. And I was kind of given like 3 years to live at that point. So that was in 2008, when I first found out what the illness was, if you will. So then I was started on a load of medication and went for transplant assessment in the August of 2011 because, basically I was told that I would die without a double lung transplant.
Lung transplants, we don't hear about them that much, do we? And I imagine that all sorts of thoughts were in your mind when you heard that you need a run.
Yeah, very, very scary to hear that that I needed a new pair of lungs and that obviously I would have to have a donor to give me those lungs. Very, very surreal situation to be in. Never expected something like this to happen to me in like my life, but obviously, everything happens for a reason, and now I do raise a lot of awareness on organ donation and about pulmonary hypertension as well. But donors are absolutely amazing and heroes.
And wonderful that they have an advocate like you to tell their stories, I imagine. How long did it take for you to find a match?
So I was really lucky, and I only waited about 4 months. I know that people can wait a couple of years, but I was extremely lucky and only waited 4 months, and it was the first call and it was the first like match So yeah, I was very lucky. Didn't wait as long as, well, some, unfortunately for some people, the call never comes. So I was extremely, very, very lucky. When I got the phone call, I was extremely poorly, like very, very, very poorly. So when the phone actually rang, I had a panic attack. I think I couldn't get my breath. I almost passed out. I had to tell the transplant coordinator to kind of hang on a second because I just was panicking at the thought of, oh my God, this is actually happening. But also, I was so hopeful that I was going to get better at the same time.
Yeah, that's what, you know, the option that you've got, isn't it, to get healthy or not to get healthy. Let's bring in Anthony into this conversation. Really important to speak to you as well. Anthony Clarkson, Director of Organ and Tissue Donation and Transplantation at NHS Blood and Transplant. When you hear, Anthony, when you hear stories like that of Natalie's, I imagine for you, nevertheless, it is still a reminder of what an important job, not just that you do, but the whole of the health service does in giving people a new lease of life.
Truly amazing stories. And it's people like Natalie that make us do our best work every day. And those other patients that are waiting for that call, as Natalie said, unfortunately, some people, the call never comes. But nevertheless, we know they're counting on us to do, to try our utmost to find them a match and to get them the organ to save their life.
And how does the system work at the moment? Do we have to still carry a donor card with us for our organs to be donated or not?
Yeah, so you don't have to. So you can choose to join the organ donor register to record your decision to be a donor or to record your decision not to be a donor. And if you don't do either, then we can deem your consent because we have an opt-out environment now.
Natalie, how did your family take it?
Very scary time for us all, for my mum and dad and my children, all the family and friends. Everybody was very worried about me, really hopeful that we get a transplant, but very difficult situation to be in, sorry, because obviously I had to wait, sadly, for someone to pass away so that I could have a second chance at life. So it's an incredible experience to go through, really. But yeah, very scary, very, very grateful as well at the same time.
How do you come to terms with that bittersweet set of circumstances? Very, you know, rewarding for you to be offered this transplant and for it to be successful, but also sad for another family who are, you know, happy to have the organs donated to you, but extremely sad because they've lost a loved one.
Yeah, I guess I just tried to live each day to the fullest, to make my donor proud, to make her family proud, make as many memories with my children as I can. And I hope that she's looking down proud that I've been, you know, she's given me her lungs. It's I'm just so grateful to her. And words can't really express how thankful and how grateful we all are to my donor and her family for saving my life. And we think about her all the time, and on our anniversary, we remember her every day with everything that we do, every extra birthday that I see, that my children see, Christmases. I'm just so thankful that I've been able to watch my children grow up thanks to her, and I hope she would be proud.
Sure. And did you get in touch with her family? Did you know who she was?
Yeah, I did. I got in touch with her brother and her niece, and very much like me and my family, very down to earth, lovely people, all very obviously grieving because they lost their loved one. But they found comfort in meeting me and knowing that she saved my life, and seeing how I live and how I make the most of my life compared to how poorly that I was. It's given them a lot of comfort with her passing away.
We have to live in awe, don't we, of people who are prepared to donate their organs and the families who have to stand by that decision as well. Under the circumstances of a loved one passing away, it's very difficult to talk to families or for families to come to terms with what you're asking them to do, which is to consent, I imagine, to their loved one's organs being donated. And this is within hours of them passing, is it?
This is, this is at the time of them passing, or the time that they've been given very bad news that they're not going to survive. So it's a really difficult time. But we have specialist nurses that can guide them through that conversation. But what many families are telling us is that it's really helpful if they know the decision of their loved one. So if they're on the organ donor register and they've made that decision, it gives them a lot of comfort that they're making the right decision and supporting the right decision. So that's why we still encourage people, even in an opt-out environment, to record the decision on the organ donor register.
It's Organ Donation Week. How do you feel about a campaign like this, an awareness campaign of the importance of organ donations? Does it work?
Yeah, it's crucial to have campaigns like this to get people talking about organ donation. It's not a subject that easily comes to, for us to come to. So having Organ Donation Week brings it to the fore. And hearing stories about life like Natalie's, it changes it from a story about dying to a story about life. And that's why Organ Donation Week is crucial. And if it makes a lot more people join the register, which we're encouraging people to do, then it's really helpful, because if they could, donate when they die, as I say, it gives the family that certainty that they've made the right decision.
And of course, it is a challenge, isn't it, to the certainty, maybe, quote unquote, of life that we are accustomed to in society. When somebody like Natalie gets a prognosis that she needs an organ donation, or when a family is, told and counselled by your expert nurses that, their child's organs are needed for donation, etc. It takes away something fundamental, maybe, that we expect from life, and it changes a way of looking and thinking. Does that make sense? But for me, it's a fundamental shift in how I think and how society thinks and what life and death is kind of about, and how we can impact on lives. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. It's because life continues after they've died, when they've donated. So there's a legacy. They leave a legacy of life for the recipients. And that's incredibly powerful. And as Natalie said, it brings the family a lot of comfort too, knowing that their loved one's gone on to save the lives of others. So it is, you're right, it's the finality is slightly different in these situations, because it's that legacy of life with the organs that they've given. It's really, really powerful. And it's an amazing area of healthcare, because you have that connection between the donor and the recipient. And we facilitate the bit in the middle for that. But it's fantastic. And the outcomes are amazing, as we heard from Natalie.
Yeah, Natalie, the conversation that we had last week on air was something of an ad hoc conversation. I at first didn't want to talk about it because it's not my business. It's a bit private. It's a bit sensitive. I'm the kind of person that gets emotional about this sort of thing, and I knew I would. But then I thought it was an important conversation to have about my wife's godson, who happened to be undergoing, well, that very day last week was when he was expected to have this transplant. And I didn't know if it had gone through, because there's so much jeopardy when you're waiting for a transplant, as you know. I didn't know if when I came on air, I didn't know if the transplant had actually happened, but I mentioned it on air to people. I was absolutely gobsmacked by the response. And just goes to show you how many people are walking about in our, surroundings who have had transplants. It's not abnormal at all. But the one thing that challenged me was, and he's had the transplant and he's well at the moment, but he's waiting for that period of time to ensure that his body doesn't reject the kidney. It was a kidney transplant. But the thing that I just couldn't get out of my head is, how has this changed our lives? I totally get the fact that it's changed his life, but I suspect it changes the life of the whole family, not least when you first get the, you know, thumbs up that everything has gone on. I don't know how to respond to him, whether I should joke and laugh the way that we used to, or whether I should be, you know, sort of tiptoeing around and being very sort of cautious of him injuring himself or falling ill in some way. Do you know how, if you could help me navigate just for a moment, Natalie, how would you, what advice would you give to me, the loved one, if you like, of the person who's had the transplant, about how we now, you know, continue our lives?
I think I can go off at my children. They were 4 and 9 when I got my transplant. Now they're 22 and 16. So obviously they've had their mum here to watch them grow up and experience everything with them. And we've just been really open and honest the whole way through it all, really. Like, we've laughed, we've cried. They are overprotective of me, more so obviously because of my transplant, catching colds and stuff, and, you know, just generally making sure that I'm well. But yeah, we just live each day to the fullest. We make so many memories and we don't take a minute for granted. And we've always just spoken about things, and I've never kind of kept anything from them. So if I have checkups and stuff, I'm always really honest with them. But yeah, I would say just be there and just and make the most of life every second with him.
What can't you do? Can you run the London Marathon?
Probably not. I could try. I've found that since my transplant, obviously with being poorly, I guess with a lot of people that have been poorly, and when you're on the other side, you do appreciate life a lot more. And I do kind of do things spur of the moment more now. Like, I want to experience everything, because you just see life in a completely different way, which you might find that he wants to just do this, that and the other and just live, because we were so close to not living. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and also paying tributes to our donors, and yeah, life's short.
Of course.
Enjoy it.
An essential part, paying tribute to your donors. And I only asked about the marathon because I know Nana, you know, my wife's godson, he's a tenacious little footballer, you know. He's not that tall, but he bites your legs, you know, metaphorically speaking. I wonder if we're going to be able to play football again like we used to, and how emotional a moment that would be.
That's it. And you'll find that a lot of moments will be extra emotional with obviously having the transplant. And I'm emotional. Christmases, birthdays, kids leaving school, school plays, just being able to see everything. It's just amazing. So just let it out. Just be emotional. Embrace it. Be happy. It's amazing. It's the gift of life.
Yeah, Natalie Kerr there, who's an organ recipient, and we heard also from Anthony Clarkson, the Director of Organ and Tissue Donation and Transplantation at NHS Blood and Transplant, because it is Organ Donation Week. And I promise you, if I can, I'll get Nana to come on air with me on one of these nights when he's much better, and, to thank you all for all your kind wishes towards him that I'll tell him about eventually. That is about it from us. Thank you for listening. Thanks to the squad, as always. Thanks to Chris and Tom in the studio. Thanks to Judy, who edited the programme. Wake Up to Money's next, but for now, as we've been talking about the return of Strictly and when you've been inspired to dance, I will leave you with Gonzalez. And I haven't stopped dancing yet.
the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will promise there'll be no return to austerity despite tough decisions on public finances in a speech at the Labour Party conference. Her address risks being overshadowed by a debate about the decision to cut the winter fuel allowance for many pensioners. Senior ministers have also been under scrutiny on the issue of donations, including holidays and clothing. Our political editor, Chris Mason, says Labour MPs and members are hoping Rachel Reeves' speech will draw a line under the row.
There's a real hunger here, a real desire for this party in government to crack on with doing stuff after years of being starved of that because they kept losing elections. And also, as I say, trying to move on from the bumpiness of the last couple of weeks.
Figures obtained by BBC News show the number of times machetes, swords and so-called zombie knives have been logged by police has almost doubled in the last 5 years. From tomorrow, it'll be illegal to possess zombie-style knives and machetes in England and Wales as an amnesty for people to surrender the weapons without prosecution comes to an end. Commander Stephen Clayman from the National Police Chiefs Council says the tackling of knife crime is complex.
Manufacturers quite cleverly got around the design, and like everything, and laws are iterative, aren't they? They have to adapt, and of course it needed to change. It will have an impact. I can't say, you know, it will be the end of the issue, because it clearly won't.
Israel says it's conducting extensive strikes on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. Last night, President Biden said the US would do everything it could to stop a wider war breaking out after a weekend of heavy cross-border fire. Campaigners have warned that the cuts to Welsh Environmental Watchdog will put nature at risk. Natural Resources Wales is seeking to close 265 posts and is considering closures to visitor centres. Stephen Messenger reports.
Natural Resources Wales says it needs to make around £13 million worth of savings and has been consulting staff on potential job cuts. The proposals include scaling back in areas such as advising on green issues and enforcement work, including tackling waste crime, though investment in dealing with water pollution will increase.